Well, this is the year of John Muir. 2010 is the year of John Muir, and we'll find out how that came to be, and we'll find out a lot more about John Muir as we visit with our guests today who have written a book about his early years in Wisconsin. Kathleen McGuinn with me in the studio. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you with us. Daryl Christensen is on as well, or will be on shortly. We don't have him on the line yet, but we'll have him very shortly, is the other author of the book. Muir is still here, a Marquette County Journal of Discovery. Daryl, by the way, he's a fishing professional, but he's published a lot, over 1,000 articles, books, and photographs, and is also well-known in the birding world for his extensive work in that field. And Kathleen has written. She's a Muir enthusiast, and we're really glad to have both Kathleen McGuinn and Daryl Christensen to talk with us today. You may want to join in with a question about John Muir. He's obviously a very important figure, not only in Wisconsin, but nationally, certainly internationally as well. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And Daryl Christensen is with us as well. Daryl, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having us this morning.
How did you two decide to put together a book on John Muir?
Well, should I go, Daryl?
Sure.
Last year, about 18 months ago, a group formed in Marquette County, which is the boyhood home of John Muir, called the John Muir Legacy Group. And that legacy group, it was just people who were interested in having John Muir's legacy more apparent in Marquette County. Well, the Montello Historic Preservation Society puts on a different exhibit each year, each summer. And we didn't have one identified for this year. And I said, well, why don't we do John Muir? This was his boyhood home. So then we went to the Marquette County Board of Supervisors, and they voted a resolution to declare 2010 the year of John Muir. And we've had activities all year long with all kinds of participation from all kinds of groups. And the Montello Historic Preservation Society really likes to do a book with each exhibit. It makes the exhibit richer, and it also captures it captures the exhibit and the information we did all the research for the future.
And Daryl, must have been fun to write about Muir.
Oh, it was exhilarating. You know, I grew up about 6 miles from where he spent his childhood and adolescent years, and visited the area many times. And of course, followed his legacy of founding the national park system, and it's just outstanding to learn about the man, but then also to walk in places that he walked and see the things that he saw.
Absolutely, you know, Ellen's online from Viroqua with a comment or question, and why don't we just go to Ellen? Ellen, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Good morning. How are you all?
Just great, thanks. And it's Alan, not Ellen. Sorry, Alan.
That's fine. It's Alan. I'm in my 50s now, but in college I had a good buddy, and we were looking for an adventure to do. And for some reason I read one of John Muir's books about Glacier Bay, and that inspired us. And we took a two-man kayak to Glacier Bay to follow his footsteps. Of course, we couldn't follow his footsteps because the glaciers were well receded by then. But we did get to see Muir Glacier. We did get to have fantastic experiences, and I owe it all to his writings.
Kathleen, comment?
Well, it sounds like a wonderful experience, and I guess I shouldn't be surprised how many people try to walk in his footsteps. He was so influential and so passionate about what he did. We had two visitors at our exhibit in Montello who wrote a book, Muir Ramble Route. Peter and Donna Thomas are their names, and they walked from San Francisco to Yosemite in the footsteps of John Muir. So there's people like you all over. I do less of spectacular walking. I just walk in Marquette County in his footsteps.
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate the call. So he was an inspiring guy, Daryl.
Well, he sure was. He had a connection to nature, especially in his era, that few people had. And today I think a lot of people are really trying to get back to that and are looking for a way to do it, an example, and a place. I think Muir is the example, that's for sure. And I think the place are those places that have been preserved that he not only helped preserve, but where he lived. I'm very fortunate to be within a few miles of his boyhood home. I can go there anytime, and you can just feel inspired. I guess is the best word, just as he did in that place. And then use that to inspire others to go there and to experience that as well.
What do we know about his Muir's early interest in nature?
Well, in his book, My Boyhood and Youth, he talks about even his adventures in Scotland before they came over here in 1849. And I believe it was his grandmother in Scotland had a garden, and his grandfather also took him rambling all over. And so he had a real connection to the outdoors even in Scotland. And then when the family moved here, of course, it was, there's a lot of paradox in Muir's life, just like in all of ours. They were early settlers. They were plowing up even Indian graves. They were plowing up the prairie. He had a multi-thousand acre fruit farm later in life. But still, he believed strongly in preserving pristine places. And he fell in love with Fountain Lake, that area around that Little Kettle Lake. He fell in love with. He tried to purchase it three times in his life.
He did. Mm-hmm. Well, he was also a student at UW-Madison. We know what he was like as a student. Daryl, do you know?
Well, when he became a student, he got more obviously into the biology and I guess ecology of the time, of which it was very little,
Yeah.
But as much as he could learn, but also he continued to work on his inventions. I think a lot of people don't look at him as an inventor, but he invented quite a few items and won awards with them.
What kinds of things did he invent?
Well, the Wisconsin State Historical Society, just up the road here, has his wake-up clock, he had a wake-up bed, but they also have a clock that moves his books for studying in a circle and would open up to a certain page. He whittled. Everything was in wood. In our book, we've got some photos of his drawings where he had a scythe clock that he whittled. I'd like to mention, too, that our exhibit in Montello takes what it was like in Marquette County when John Muir settled here, but then it brings you up to the present where you can still see what John Muir saw in Marquette County. And with that said, we had a gentleman in Neshkoro that made an all-wood clock. He carved an all-wood clock. And that sits in front of the two drawings that Muir had of things that he whittled. So it's really a really nice blend of today and then.
And Daryl, maybe you could talk about how your book is organized to highlight Muir's life here.
Well, I guess from my standpoint in my part of the book, I tried to capture in essence the things that Muir observed. He didn't just see things, but he observed things in a much greater or grander scale than most people would. And when you visit there and you read the book, you read about the birds, you saw the animals, just the prairie and how everything was connected, how everything interacted with each other, which we call ecology today. It's amazing how you make that transition from a seer to an observer, and there's a big difference. And that's the type of man he was, and you begin to really understand how he realized that. That's a big catchphrase today, that we're all connected, everything's connected, we're all part of the chain and all that thing. But he understood that 160 years ago, and that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. Dave in Augusta has a comment or question for you, so let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
I've got a question. If I remember correctly, I read that John Muir went to school at UW-Madison. I believe he stayed at North Hall, which was the first dormitory, I think. And then there was an area right across Observatory Drive, which is now Observatory Drive, that he used to sit there and do some of his readings and some of his writings. There was a tree there, I think, that they called it the Muir Tree.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that got taken down when they expanded Observatory Drive. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I believe that tree was the Muir Locust. I believe that's right. And the locust is how he first really learned about botany, and his interest in the science of botany started. He noticed that the pod of the locust was so much like a pea, and then started connecting and really studying botany, and went from there.
And he suffered, I believe, suffered an eye injury.
In Indiana, yes, in 1867, I think it was. 1867. He was in Indiana making inventions, actually, to make a factory much more efficient. He was really good at that. And he had a piece of metal fly back in his eye. And the way he describes it, he was blind in the one eye, and his other eye sympathetically went blind. So he was totally blind. And it was at that point in his life that he decided that he would never work in factories again, but that because he was so afraid that he'd never see his beloved nature again. So that was a huge turning point in his life. And after that, he came back to Marquette County and stayed with his family for a while he healed.
And he was eventually able to...
See. Yeah, totally. Yeah, he got vision in both eyes.
Yeah, but...
Larry, to get back to your question on how the book is laid out, you know, as you are well aware, Kathleen's a Muir historian.
Yeah.
And the book, you know, talks about those days, what it was like for all people... immigrating to the U.S. and especially to that part of Wisconsin, and most were Scottish immigrants, and it kind of takes people on a journey through that, and not only what Muir faced, but what all people faced in those days, and you know, the hardships especially, but also there's a tremendous amount of history throughout the book about Muir's family, those days. When they were here, and then my part of it was more on the nature or natural side of John Muir, as being a naturalist and a preservationist myself, it was
made sense.
For me to do that.
It made sense for you to do that, as
it made sense for me to do that, right?
You know, his family. I'd like to know a little bit more about his family. Can you talk about that? Maybe Kathleen, you can talk about that.
Yeah, first I want to say I'm a lay historian because I'm not a historian by trade. I learn a lot every time we do an exhibit. So, they came over in 1849. His sister Sarah, his brother David, and his father Daniel. And Muir was 11 years old, and their journey took about 6.5 weeks over the ocean, and they ended up in Marquette County mostly because they were going to settle in Canada, and then mostly because there was the talk about the Portage Canal, they ended up looking for land in Wisconsin, so they settled there, and they. Like most settlers did, the first thing they put up was a Baroque shanty, and we had volunteers make a shanty in the style of John Muir's, which is at our exhibit. It's really fun to see a Baroque shanty. And in 9 months, though, they broke ground, and they had a two-story house built when the rest of the family came over. And, you know, the Muirs weren't poor. They hired help. They had hired hands, but they worked very, very hard. So that's how they came here.
And what was his father's occupation?
Well, he was a merchant and a storekeeper, and he had been in the military. And then he became a preacher. And I might want to add that on September 11th at the Wee White Kirk, which is a Scottish church in Marquette County, we're going to have a cemetery walk there. John Muir's nephew is buried there. And... Daryl Christensen is going to preach like Daniel Muir in the Wee White Kirk, which is Daniel Muir preached in that church.
Well, what kind of a preacher was he, Daryl?
Well, he You know, it's really hard to find that out, but we did know that he was of an order called the Disciples of Christ. And you would think in those days it would have been all fire and brimstone and hell and damnation, but it actually that group was more of a teaching love and peace and getting along with one another. So which was kind of contrary to his seemingly harsh nature.
Yeah, Daniel Muir was a real authoritarian and very hard. John Muir talks about being switched constantly and him digging an 80-foot well and almost dying down there. But even though John Muir was bitter about how he was treated by his father, he wrote a most beautiful obituary, which is in our book, When His Father Died. And I think that there's a lot of, there's a lot of stuff that you don't understand in a family, and I'm certainly not saying that how Daniel Muir raised his children was right, but one of the Whitehead boys argued with John Muir after My Boyhood and Youth came out and said that he shouldn't have talked about their fathers being so strict, that Daniel Muir, when he came back from the Civil War and was expected to die, Daniel Muir sat by his side every day and was very gentle with him. And so there was two sides to him.
Talking about John Muir's life in Wisconsin with Kathleen McGuinn and Daryl Christensen, they are the authors of Muir Is Still Here, a Marquette County Journal of Discovery. Join in with your questions and comments about John Muir at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will go back to the phones here and talk with some more of you about John Muir. Let's go to Ann in Madison next. Ann, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about John Muir's sweet character. Although his father was, he was a Scot and kind of driven man and ultra religious, he really made life hard for John as a child. And despite that, John Muir accomplished just an incredible amount. And although he did, I believe, have, before his father's death, he didn't speak to him for a long time because his father asked him for money for staying there when he came to visit. He was just terrible. He made John do, at a very young age, do a huge amount of the hard work of clearing the land, I believe, at Fountain Lake. And he was just in modern terms, he was an abusive father, but John Muir is just the most wonderful person, and it's really worth a visit to the Wee White Kirk. It's that part of Wisconsin is kind of an unknown and not much, touristed part of the state, and it's still pretty much probably almost the way it was in John Muir's time.
Yeah. Comments? Thank you for calling, Ann. Kathleen?
Yeah. John Muir was a very gentle person. Daniel Muir treated all his children that way. Sarah, his sister, married David Galloway, and when David Galloway came home from a trip from Scotland, he was shocked at what Sarah looked like because Daniel had bought a second farm, Hickory Hill Farm, and Sarah was having to do the work in two farmsteads. So he treated all his children that way. But the mother was extremely gentle, and I think maybe some of that came from John Muir, plus that innate love of, even as a boy, he did the things boys did sometimes with killing animals and taking birds from their nests. But he recognized that animals were special in the world and had as many rights as we have. And that innate sense of that, I think, contributed to his gentleness.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you very much. Yeah, we haven't heard much about the mother.
Yeah, right. The father, Daniel Muir, finally went off to Canada and preached up there. Really felt that was his job, to save souls, so to speak. And Ann Muir, I guess I look at it as she was a woman of her time and had to do kind of what her husband said. However, Her father, who never wanted her to come to the United States, her father left her a stipend. And so she was able to be somewhat independent and help some of the other kids. You know, I will make one comment that the other family members all stayed and took care of the father and the mother and the land. And John Muir went off, and he had the freedom to do that because of his family members who were willing to take the responsibility for all of that other stuff. And they supported him a lot.
There we have it. Thank you again, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. Dale in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm curious as to whether you've explored the relationship between John Muir and a woman named Jean Slocum Carr, whom he met at the university and later visited and corresponded with and later visited in California.
Well, first of all, there's a great book of letters between John Muir and Jean Carr. And we are our Marquette County Master Gardeners, Timeshares Master Gardeners, is bringing the editor, author of that book, Bonnie Gissel, on October 16th to Marquette County.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and she's going to do a full day of children's activities, and then she's going to speak at the museum at 55 West Montello Street, and she's going to speak about her work with John Muir. I know that she also has a beautiful book of his pressed plants that was released not too long ago. Jean Carr was one of the people who really, you know, John Muir, in my opinion, might have gone into the woods and we'd never have heard from him again. But it was people like Jean Carr who kept encouraging him and cajoling him to write. And she edited a lot of his work. I mean, it was that relationship that really, really, one of many people, but she was really influential with getting him to publish.
Could you explain about how they met?
Oh, her husband was a professor at the university here in Madison.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
And am I correct that Jean Slocum Carr and her husband then moved later to Berkeley?
Yes, moved to. I'm not positive it was Berkeley, but they moved to California.
Okay.
Yep. And then Jean Carr would send people to John Muir in Yosemite and other places.
Right.
She was always sending people to him to learn from him and also to get him to be at ease more with talking to people about his goals and his desires and passions.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Donna in Montello will turn to you now. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to know where the book that Kathleen and Daryl wrote, where it can be purchased, and where we can find a schedule of the activities that are going on during this time that the exhibit is in view.
All right, Daryl, do you want to start with that?
Well, of course, the books can be purchased at the exhibits. It's open every week on Friday and Saturdays from 10 till 4. So they can be purchased there, and they can also you can also contact Kathleen, and I'll let her give you that website.
Yeah, if you go to www.kathleenmcguinn.com, that's KathleenMcGwin.com, there's information about how you can purchase the book that way.
Kathleen McGuinn, McGwin, that last name, just so that you've got that. Donna, thank you.
And the schedule of the activities.
Oh, the schedule, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, that schedule is also, if you go to my website, that KathleenMcGuinn.com, and click on Montello Historic Preservation Society, there's a link, that will bring up the entire schedule. And there are things being added all the time. We started out with a Robert Burns birthday supper, which the Scottish people always had. We had a tea in the afternoon. We had scones and shortbreads made by everybody around the county. We had them coming out our ears. So we had Scottish dancers, and we've had four people who have played, who have been reenactors. Ed Thaliker has reenacted John Muir at different events. Our district attorney, Dick DeFore, is Robert Burns. One of our sheriff's captains, Jack Frost, is Teddy Roosevelt. And then we have a retired library director, Bruce Duthlifson, who has been Ralph Waldo Emerson. So we've had a lot of fun with this.
Oh, it sounds great. Donna, thank you.
We're actually having a book signing and a parade on the 21st of August at Father Marquette Days in Montello. And Kathleen and I will be set up at the park and signing books on that day at that event as well.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Thanks for
Donna.
Calling. And Patricia, hello to you in Madison.
Good morning. My initial question was also if there was a website available with the information on these activities, but you've just provided that. I do know, I believe he had two daughters, and I was wondering if there are any descendants.
There are descendants. When John Muir Park in Marquette County was dedicated a number of years ago now, one of his granddaughters came to that. I don't know, though, other than that. There are descendants, but I don't know who they are and where they live.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for calling. Mukesa in Viroqua, we're on to you now. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having this program.
Sure.
A question I'd like to ask for both Kathleen and Daryl to comment on is about John Muir's spiritual connection with nature.
All right. Daryl, we'll start with you.
Sure, thank you. Well, John had memorized at an early age many books of the Bible because, his father was made him do that. Initially, John looked at everything from that perspective of a creator God and how all of nature was his. And through time and through, education and through other processes, I'm not sure he ever disallowed that, but he began to be connected more to creation than perhaps a creator or maybe blended the two, which you could tell by his writings. But even at a time when at his father's death and all that, he still talked to his father about the things he learned about nature and his connection to nature and how his address had changed from a physical address to just the universe. He called the universe his address, and again that was that spiritual connection that he felt he had and everyone had in being connected with everything that's out there, that everything is connected to each other. And I guess that's something you either learn from an early age or are taught by your parents or you experience through living a long life like he did and actually going out and being part of what he considered the creation instead of just being a user of it.
Hmm. And Kathleen?
Well, he was, he changed from kind of the organized religion. He even said, in one of the letters that I read that he wrote to a family in California that he stayed with as a young man, he said, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know how you put up with my proselytizing, because he was for a while a lot like his father that way, very strict and thought these are the things you should do. They were in our book. I refer to the Moral Class book. Early settlers, and including the Muir family, really sought ways that they could live a moral life, and John Muir did the same thing. Then that shifted, I think, from an all seeing God to the God within the universe. That the universe is God. He still was extremely. He was very, very spiritual until the day he died. But his view of God really shifted, and his view of how you lead a moral life really shifted. And the cruelty was out for him. Of course, his father, kept in his later years of his life changed too. His father kept telling the daughter he was living with to treat her children with only kindness and love, and not the way he had treated his children.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you for that question. Appreciate it. And someone had asked earlier about living relatives, and Linda emailed us and said that the great-great-grandniece of Muir owns a small apartment house in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and Linda rents from her every winter. And she said, Molly Muir is elderly but able.
Oh, how wonderful to hear. thanks for emailing that.
We have more callers online. By the way, still some time for you to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Kelly in Randolph, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this great show. And I'd like to congratulate Daryl and Kathleen on a beautiful book. I have acquired a copy of it. And I guess I don't really have a question, but I would like to make the comment that the book places us in the footsteps of Mir, and it grounds us in the many, oftentimes overlooked and forgotten treasures of the land. And I was interested in the spiritual conversation that just took place a few minutes ago, because I think it's so oftentimes overlooked. I think the book also harbors such a nice tie to the indigenous flora and fauna of the Montello Marquette County area. And also, I'd like to point out that it's such a compliment to Millie Stanley's book, The Heart of John Muir's World, that I also would encourage everyone to acquire and read at first opportunity. But back to what I said at the beginning, I'm very pleased to have acquired a copy of Daryl and Kathleen's book, and congratulations.
Thanks, Kelly. I want to tell you about, you were on my list of writing a letter to, the John Muir Legacy Group, through the hard work of Tom Ellington, has printed a special limited edition of Millie Stanley's book with her permission. And on August 29th, there's only 100 copies. There's a beautiful cover done by Tom Ellington, who lives in Buffalo Township. And on August 29th at 1 o'clock, she'll be with her son at Vaughn Hall at 55 West Montello Street in Montello, signing copies of this book, and there's only 100. People have been trying to get this book. It's been out of print for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Kathleen who said she taught in the late 90s a group of first, second, and third graders in a public Montessori program, wanted them to be exposed to John Muir. There were no materials available to teach children and the young about Muir, so she created her own, developed a unit of study for them about John Muir, his early life travels, love of nature, and his contributions to the national park system. She said, I even created my own beginning reader books about him, and we concluded the unit by bringing John Pellrine, who came into the classroom and did a wonderful impression of Muir. And she says, I bet that one of those children today know who John Muir is, every one of them, and a few important facts about his life, his love of nature, and independent way of thinking.
I'm so happy to hear that, because too often John Muir is forgotten. And he had such a huge impact. And plus, his thoughts are so fresh when you read him today. And that's really nice to hear.
Let's take another call. John in Genoa will turn to you now. Hi, John.
How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to, I just turned the radio on and heard his name. I grew up in Marin County, California.
Yeah.
And there is a John Muir Woods Park, and it's one of the most beautiful parks and of these huge redwoods in Marin County. And it's, if anybody is ever out in that area, they really should take a look at these giant redwoods, and it's one of the most beautiful places you'd ever want to see. And I just wanted to relay that to your guest. Have heard of this park or have visited?
Yeah.
And if so, her feedback will be great. I'll take her answer off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. And Daryl may have too, but let's start with Kathleen.
Yeah. No. I know of its existence, and I get lots of feedback from people about how beautiful it is. And maybe someday I'll get there. And thanks for telling us about it.
And Daryl, have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So, but it's, I'm sure, absolutely a beautiful place. And Muir Park, again, where is it located and what does it contain?
It's on County Trunk F, just south of Montello, maybe about seven miles south of Montello. There's a small Mode Park. There's Fountain Lake, which is called Ennis Lake. Ennis was another of the early settlers, and so Ennis Lake is there, and that's what the Muir family called Fountain Lake. And then there's a beautiful prairie that's been restored by prairie enthusiasts, and the DNR works really hard on that park. And there's a 2.3-mile trail around the lake, which is part of the Ice Age Trail.
And what about Syl Adrian?
Oh, Syl Adrian. His daughter is...
He was an inventor, by the way.
Yes, yeah. He did the X-ray shoe machine. He invented that, which we have one at our Marquette County Historical Society. Actually, he's featured in the book. If it wasn't for Syl Adrian, there may not be a Muir Park. In 1946, he was an interesting man. And his daughter, Sylvia, lives in Madison and supplied us with a photo of him. But he... thought that John Muir's memory should be preserved in Marquette County, and he worked just diligently, endlessly, trying to make that happen, along with some other people then who jumped on board. But he really is the one, the impetus behind the John Muir Park and remembering his legacy in Marquette County.
Well, I'll tell you what, he was a fascinating character, a fascinating person. I shouldn't say character, person. And you've done a lot in this book to bring his early life to our attention. And I want to thank you both very much for being with us. And let's go back to some of the events that are coming up that relate to the book and to you.
Okay. The exhibit Muir is Still Here is open through August, Fridays and Saturdays, 10 to 4, and by appointment. If you go to my website and contact me from there, I'll open it up any day of the week. It's also open for school events through October. August 7th, we're having a wonderful young woman, Kristen Westlake, who's hiking the Ice Age Trail and who's a nature photographer. She lives in Lake Geneva, and she's going to be talking about her hiking on the Ice Age Trail and reconnecting through nature with photography. So that's our next event. But then we also have Millie Stanley's book signing. We have Bonnie Gissel in October. And again, that's all on my website. So.
And the website again is Kathleen
McGuinn,
excuse me. And let's spell that McGuinn. So we get that right. KathleenMcGuinn.com.
Yep. And you click on Montello Historic Preservation Society and you'll see the whole schedule of events.
Kathleen, Daryl, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, and thanks for all the people who called in.
Appreciate it very much. Kathleen McGuinn and Daryl Christensen, who are the authors of Muir is Still Here, a Marquette County Journal of Discovery. Great to have them with us, and it's also nice to remember people who have Wisconsin ties, strong Wisconsin ties, who have affected us not only here, but across the nation and across the world. John Muir. Coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk about animals, particularly maybe reptiles. We'll talk reptiles and animal health with Dr. Marla Lichtenberger, who's an emergency critical care veterinarian and owner of the Milwaukee Emergency Center for Animals. That coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.